This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that send. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte. Southern Teague is out of town right now, so we won't be bantering with that goofball. He's down in South Carolina, having some fun down there. And I'm here, actually, today with someone I haven't had a chance to catch up with in a while. But I'm really glad that we're doing this today. Welcome to the show, Lacey Hawkins.
Thank you.
Great to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good. How are you?
Awesome. Just peachy.
It's nice to see you, too. I've actually saved this question until we were on the air. We were chatting a little bit beforehand, but now that I've got you, now that I've got you pegged, I wanted to know if I'm the only person who's ever called you the cocktail cowboy, and if that has caught on yet.
I think it's caught on a little bit.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm happy to scream it from the rooftops more often, but okay. All
That's
right.
Very flattering.
Okay.
I can't wear my cowboy hat right now, though, because I got these headphones on.
Sure.
But after the show.
You could get a cowboy hat, though, that like...
It just like fits over?
Yeah, almost like Mickey Mouse ear cutouts, and you could sort of put it underneath.
Dave, you hear that? We're going to get on that.
Yeah.
It's probably on Amazon.
Somebody's going to sponsor that. Somebody's going to have to sponsor that.
Cool. So, yeah, let's talk about what's going on. I mean, how long have you been in New York now? You're originally from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, I'm coming off of my four-year anniversary. I think it'll be like September 21st.
Wow.
It'll be my four-year anniversary. And it really does. My stepmom went to college in New York and lived in New York for a number of years. And she, I don't know if this is true for every city, but she always said, like, it takes 2 years to get used to New York. Because, like, the first year, you're just... like finding your, you know, asshole from your elbow. I mean, you're just trying to operate and figure out how to get from one place to another. And the second year, you really start to put down roots. And that couldn't have been more true for me. And I also think one of the biggest helps that I had in terms of becoming comfortable in New York City was getting a bicycle. And, you know, you get on the subway and you get off somewhere totally. And my only real... interpretation of that area was whoever I saw getting on or off the stop. And that's just a, you know, huge disservice. So getting a bicycle was awesome. And I got to see so much more. And ironically, I had to walk around the city the other day. I think it was due to weather or something, or maybe it was what I was carrying. I couldn't take my bike. And I had always said, from taking the subway to biking, like, man, I just see so much. I can cover so much ground, and I see so many more things, and I know where everything is now. And then when I was walking, I was like, wow, I've been biking past this place for years, and I just read the sign, and it's amazing, you know? Yeah. So it just really kind of took it to another level when I put my feet on the ground. But yeah, 4 years.
Yeah, I had a similar situation in New York where I've always had, like, kind of, like, bad social anxiety, which is funny because I'm hosting a radio show and I work in bars. But
and also you're in New York City, which like the MTA, the massively failing MTA, like
totally.
It's just a social anxiety waiting to happen.
I would, yeah, absolutely. It probably hasn't gotten any better since I moved here, but I've been here over a decade, so I don't know. It hasn't killed me yet. But I would like my first like investment for. I think it was like maybe like a weekend. I purchased some really expensive headphones and I was like, all right, cool. I'm going to need these cause I'm in New York and I'm going to, you know, listen to music and podcasts and stuff whenever I'm walking around town. And then I realized like, I was talking with my brother one day about it and he's like, why are you ignoring the city? It's like, you're missing out on a lot. It's like, just like, I'm like, well, you know, like the crazy people on the train or like on the street. I'm like, I can't deal with them yet. I'm not like, accustomed to New York City yet. But then after a while, I was like, all right, no, I need to listen to to the city.
To tune in. I mean, I also think it's kind of dangerous when you tune everything out.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to know, I like to keep my eye on the crazies.
Yeah.
And I have this device for when I'm riding my bike. It's basically like a speaker that I'll clip onto my collar so I can hear music and skip songs, and it'll play directions for me too. And I don't have to look at my phone, and I can still hear all the surrounding traffic, which is great.
Cool.
Speaking of your brother, actually, I think right when I had moved here, it was at Prime Meats. I'm 90% sure it was at Prime Meats, and I had just moved to the city. I was sitting at the bar, like having a drink or having some food or something, and I looked to my left, and it was you or him. I have no idea. And I kind of looked to my right, and it was you or him. I had no idea. And there was a mirror in front. That's why I think it might have been Prime Meats. It's a big mirror back bar, right? And I was just like looking at both. I mean, I was kind of confused. Like, is this an optical illusion? Like, there was just a little bit too much going on. And I did it one more time, and I think it was you. You're like, yeah, we're like the male version of the Mixed Sisters. I think it was you. And I was like, cool. I had never met you guys before or anything. And I think that was the only thing you said to me. But I was like, wow, so many twins.
That's funny, man.
Yeah.
a lot of twins. Wait, okay, so let's talk about that. Like, you were working at, when you first moved here, you moved here one day. Like, the second day, you interviewed at both the Nomad and Clover Club. And then by the third day, you were hired at both of them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's insane. Like,
it's insane. And getting those jobs both at the same time and learning both of their cocktail programs, which are so vastly different and also very thorough. My brain was melting. I mean, getting those jobs was 95% luck and 5% timing, period. I was coming from Portland, Oregon, where I really felt like I was a big fish in a small pond. And then I moved to New York and realized, oh my God, I know absolutely nothing. And like, put your head down and shut your mouth and just learn, which learning is great. Putting my head down is fine, but shutting my mouth has always been really hard for me to do. So, I really... New York has always been very, very good to me. And people talk about sort of like these horror stories of New York and how it's going to be such a hard city and chew you up and spit you out. And I've never had that experience. It's always been very good to me. And I've always said I'll stay as long as it keeps being so good to me. And it is. I've found the love of my life here. I have an amazing job. I learned more than I ever thought I could behind the bar. I have great friends and a wonderful place to live. But the first 3 months or so I was here, I was like sleeping on top of my clothes and underneath my clothes at the same time because I didn't have time to find a bed. And I also I'm not a naive person. I considered myself to be very street smart, but I didn't realize how used to my life I was in Portland.
Sure.
And I kind of think I thought, oh, I'll just move to New York and I'll live the same life. And you just don't.
It's one of a kind.
Yeah. It took me a while to figure out how to operate in New York, like where to get my groceries and where to get my mattress and how to do laundry, all these things, right. That were so easy for me to handle when I was in Portland because
you had a garden in your backyard and you had a washer and dryer
exactly.
in your house.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And every place does. Yeah. And everything there is so aesthetically set for you. I mean, I think, you know, I had a huge, huge culture shock when I moved to New York. I did not know how white Portland was. I really didn't. And I grew up around people of color and still didn't know. And it wasn't until I moved into Crown Heights, which is the part I live in is just right on the border, Crown Heights and Bed-Stuy, and really had to be uncomfortable with my whiteness. And that was really good for me. And I highly recommend that every white person at some point in their life is in a position where they are the minority, because it really made me recognize how much privilege I had had. And also along with that came a lot of white guilt, which, you know, I got to put aside and figure out how to function in a very diverse society.
Yeah.
And that was really good for me. And I don't think I ever knew that I was missing that. I never knew I was lacking that.
Just that's really
things you didn't think you were going to sign up for. And all of a sudden,
yeah. I mean, like we were saying actually before the show, it's like this city takes a lot of hard work, and it takes like some thick skin. And there's like a lot of things that you aren't prepared for. You never even know that it's going to come at you, like, in the city. And, like, you learn just, you learn a lot about yourself, yeah. the way you work, the way you, like, love, you know. Like,
yeah.
It's a shocker.
Yeah.
But it's so good. It is right. And, like, coming here, like, I would say New York City's not a vacation town. You come here and, like, you hustle your ass off and, like, you just, like,
yeah.
It's like, I don't understand why people come here for yeah. vacation, honestly. Yeah. It's like, I'm like, the idea of tourism in New York, I get it. Like, look at some stuff, but, like,
get out. Get out while you can. Yeah. It's like the polished version of Vegas. Like, don't stay too long. Yeah, when I met my girlfriend, I think it was on our first date. At the time, she had been in New York for, like, I think, like, 15 years. And I was just floored. I was like, you monster. What are you doing here? You just must love torture. Like, why? You're not supposed to be here this long. You're supposed to come in, get your nut, get out, right? Like, come in, somehow make yourself into a diamond, and then get out before it's too late.
Yeah.
And yeah, now she's going on, I don't know, like 17 or 18 years. So, and I'm here. So,
yeah.
But
speaking of, like, we were talking about that before. So, you have recently become brand ambassador for Monkey 47,
yeah.
Gin, mm-hmm. and which is a really fucking great product, man. I was prepping myself for the show last night by drinking it.
Oh, yeah. Well, cool. I actually brought you something really cool. So, the Monkey 47 is distributed in 500 milliliter bottles in Asia and Europe and South America, but in the US, it's in 375 milliliter bottles for now.
For now, okay.
For now. That's, for now.
You could feel that question bubbling up.
Yeah,
right?
It's just for now. But the only Monkey 47 expression that we have in the States is the classic Monkey 47, but they make a distiller's cut every year that is the same 47 herbs and botanicals, and plus they pitch one other ingredient in. Last year, in fact, they used honey from the apiary that they have at the distillery. And, I mean, the gin is beautiful. The distillery is stunning. And the apiary, as someone who's also a beekeeper, like, I mean, just blew my mind. German design, I don't think we give it near enough credit. I think IKEA kind of came in and stole the show a little bit. But so many beautiful things are designed from Germans. And the distillery is in the middle of the Black Forest in Germany. And it is just so satisfying to look at and to be a part of and to stand there, and, you know, everything is in its place and there's a place for everything. It's really wonderful. But so they make these different distillers cuts every year, and I brought you for us to taste the slow gin that they make.
Cool.
This is the coolest slow gin I've ever had. It's still the same 47 different herbs and botanicals, and then they pitch in a lot more slow berries. There are already slow berries in the gin already, but they add some more. And
in the original
recipe, yeah, there are slow berries in there. And so the first time I tried this was actually at a bar in San Francisco called Whitechapel, which is a gin bar. Yeah. And the bartender, like, it was in like a reserve cabinet, and he let me taste a really small sample. I mean, I think they were charging like $50 an ounce. I mean, something pretty high. He let me try a little sample, and it tasted like kind of bitter and rich. And I felt like it would be a really cool substitute for Campari and a Negroni at some point. And then I didn't taste it again until the last time I was at the distillery in May. And I tried it again, and I was like, oh my God, it's totally different. It's like acidic and bright and like cranberry notes. And you think of slow gins as being sort of these like maraschino syrup, dense, heavy, yeah. like sugary, I don't know what to do with them kind of things. But this is bright and fresh and it's wonderful. And that's when I realized it bitters over time. It really oxidates and bitters over time. So I brought some of that for us to try. And then we're also drinking a Negroni with Monkey 47. But this one is made with dry gin instead of, dry vermouth instead of sweet vermouth. So it's like a really lean Negroni, but it also has these sort of like Castelvetrano butter notes to it as well, as opposed to some of the deeper, maybe let's say like lighter leather notes that you might get in a sweet vermouth. And so Monkey 47 is distilled from molasses and sugar beets, and it's made in 100 liter batches in a 100 liter still. So it carries a lot of weight, has a lot of copper contact. It can be really dense. I really think it's sometimes like a beautiful fusion of gin and an eau de vie. And cool. So for me, with Campari and sweet vermouth, sometimes it can just be a little little too dense or too rich. So the dry vermouth really tends to thin it out, and I feel like it's ready to drink instantly. Whereas sometimes if I make a Negroni, obviously it's going to be hot and rich in the beginning and sort of like mellows out in the middle, like an old fashioned, and then nice and watered down at the finish. But this is like a neon red or like Jolly Rancher pink colored cocktail that's like ready to go as soon as you pour it over ice. And I have started to move away from my purest ways, and I just batch it in my apartment, and I leave it out, and I like put it in bottles. So I do an ounce and a half of Monkey 47, one Campari, and one dry vermouth. I think any Negroni needs to be made with an ounce and a half of gin. It's kind of like a disservice not to. But I just batch it, and I'll put it back into the bottles, and I won't even refrigerate it. I won't dilute it, but I just think that obviously dry vermouth and any vermouth should be refrigorated, but I just, I think it gets a little funky.
You just overly fortified it, so it's it's going to be fine.
Yeah, and then it's perfect because friends will show up, I grab a bottle, grab some twists, and just pour it over ice, and it's ready to go. I don't have to make cocktails because they're already made, and I think sometimes when you're in the beverage industry, while I love making drinks, and making drinks at home is my favorite way because the drinks are always great, right? Like no one ever sends them back. Nobody ever complains. But I also like to hang out with my friends too, or we grab a bottle and we go to the beach, or I can send it to people's houses or something. So it's really nice, easy way to just make good drinks.
Speaking of not making cocktails.
Yeah.
You recently, after taking this job, I just want to say pretty quickly, this Negroni is delicious, especially on like an 85 degree day
like
in Brooklyn.
It?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah, it's really, it's pretty lean. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, we got to try
me
that slow gin too. I'll crack the bottle while you're talking.
No, I was just going to say that you recently got out from behind the bar to take this job.
Yeah.
And
I got out.
You got out.
Escape. No.
How do you feel about that? I mean, I know it's something that, like we were talking about before the show, it's like moving to New York City. It's like, you kind of like never know where it's going to lead you. And it is a place where you get your nut and like move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
Was leaving the bar and, cause I mean, like, let's not forget to mention that you won Speed Rack. Nice. You won Speed Rack twice.
Oh, well, I mean, if you want to talk about the times, I will be happy to tell you that I actually won it four times.
Wait, four times? Great.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Well, I think it was four times. Yeah. More or less. I started competing in Speed Rack during its first year when I was still in Portland, and I got second place that year in Portland. But then it was amazing. I mean, I have Speed Rack to thank for so many things. It really just opened me up to this idea that like, oh my God, I could do that. I mean, I remember seeing like the very first Speed Rack promo video that had ever come out. And my friend was like, you got to do that if that ever comes to Portland. And I was like, yeah. And then it did. And we were like, oh shit. And I was like, you know, training with water in the bottles, like a Marriott bar, you know? I mean, but I didn't know that those kinds of opportunities existed for women behind the bar. I didn't know that women could be so fucking great. I didn't know it existed. I didn't know that caliber was out there. And it's embarrassing to say that, but I'm also proud to say that like watching other women in this industry have made me want to become a better human being. Full stop.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, so I took second place in Portland the first year, and then the next year I won in Seattle. As for like the West Coast area, and then moved to New York the following year. And every year I competed in the finals, in the nationals, because I had either won or got like enough votes from people, which is just it's just like begging for friends. It's terrible. But yeah, I won New York twice, two years in a row, which was really cool, which was really cool. And then, so weird, but so cool. And then I won the nationals. I got second place one year, and then I think the next year, I think I won. I can't remember, but it happened. I remember it happened. It was like a really hard to reach itch in the middle of my back, and I was so satisfied to finally get it done because I felt like that was my goals. Like I just wanted to win it. I just wanted to do it. And I'm so thankful that I didn't win my first year because my head would have just be. in the clouds with my ego. I
at that point, you kind of stop learning, right? You think? Like once you hit a certain level, then you're like, then you kind of like, all right, yeah, like your ego kind of takes over. Then you're like, you're kind of unaccepting of like new knowledge of like.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think in the first year that I did it, I think I would have just thought I'm such a hotshot. Yeah, like, oh, I don't need to learn anything else. I don't need to do anything else, because I would have felt so good about my own position. But the reality is that wasn't true. And I, you know, I think that Speed Rack is not real bartending at all. It's not. I mean, you're on like a catering.
It's competition bartending.
But it also,
also you
have to be so.
Also, you didn't pour me any slow jet.
Well, my arms are nowhere near as long as yours. Here, take mine. It has like a noyo taste to it. It's more like an almond taste. And that's really what a slow gin should be like. It's really getting at like the core of like an apricot seed or apricot pit.
I know what you're saying though about the competition. Oh shit, this is really good. Wow, yeah, I was not expecting that.
No, right? Wait, this is a slow gin? Like, is this what a slow gin fizz could taste like?
Yeah.
I'd love to find out.
We'll find out later, because you're coming to guest bartend at Grand Army after this from 5 to 7. Yeah. So that'll be cool. But I mean, like the bartending competition thing, it's like, you know, it's weird to me because like when I, yes, it is. It is very like very cool, but like it's not the full thing.
No.
And like if I like I've watched you in Speed Rack like a couple times, and it's been really awesome because I know you personally, and like I come to see you at Clover Club, and I've seen you at the Nomad, and like I'm like that's my friend. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I mean, like competition bartending doesn't make you like the it's not going to help you necessarily. It's cool and it's awesome.
I don't think
win,
it should be the measurement for one's abilities or success.
Yeah.
But people do like to poo-poo competition bartending. And every single time I've competed in a competition, whether it's the PAMA competition, which by the way, they have really sweet prizes. So I'm not afraid to win $5,000. Okay. Okay. Whether it's the PAMA competition or Speed Rack or Diageo World Class or whatever, you know, you learn something every single time. And and while I think some bar owners and maybe even bartenders feel like it takes away from the work and the integrity of being behind the bar and the guest and the cocktail that you're going to make the guest, it made me a better bartender because I had cool things to talk about with the guests. I got my mind working. I work really well with making new drinks based on a story. So if you just tell me like, make me something gin and refreshing, like, yeah, okay, I'll make that for you. But if you tell me, make me the cocktail that you would want if you, had just gotten done swimming in the ocean and, you're about to go like play croquet. You got it, man. I can't wait to make that drink, right? My friend Tyler Caffell and I actually play this game. Maybe we can play it on air a little bit. We'll see. I don't want to take over your show, but it's really fun. And so it would go something like this. I would say to you, what is in the Speakeasy Radio cocktail? That's,
man.
God, what is that? It's, I think there's some overproof bourbon in there, and there's like a little bit of Chenar, and it's got
that's this other Teague side, right?
Yeah, it's definitely stirred though. I feel like it's stirred because, you know, like Speakeasy wouldn't really be shaking your juices or citrus and sugar.
It's definitely stirred.
Yeah, I think it's got like overproof bourbon.
Souther doesn't know how to shake
some Chenar with his shoulder. I mean, thank God he broke it a little, guess. I think there's a flamed orange twist on it. A little bit of, what's in there? I'm missing something. What's in that drink? The Speakeasy Radio cocktail?
I think it's definitely stirred. It's in a rocks glass.
Okay.
But it's Sazerac style. So no ice.
Oh yeah. So, is there like a Peychaud's rinse in there instead of an absinthe rinse?
There's probably Peychaud's. throw out there because I love Pinot de Chardin. Oh no, there's gonna be Benedictine.
Oh, that's it. That's what was in it. Yeah, yeah. The Speakeasy Radio cocktail. It's overproof bourbon, Chenard, Benedictine with a Peychaud's rinse and a flamed orange twist, Sazerac style. I love that drink.
I love you. Let's take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll continue talking with Lacey Hawkins.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
And we're back. You're listening to the Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. And today in the studio, we have Lacey Hawkins. And I'm so fucking excited to have you here.
It's pretty cool.
Great. I'm having a great time.
I'm having a good time, too.
Cool. So, we were just talking. We should, you know what? Southern's out. Southern's out. You're my new co-host.
All right, I'll do it.
We just have too much to talk about.
Sorry, Southern could be your first guest.
Dave's having a great time in the studio today. So, we were talking about before the show or before the break. We talked a little bit about Speed Rack. It's fucking amazing. And you obviously are brand ambassador for Monkey 47, which we're enjoying right now. We're having a couple of drinks. We're having a Negroni and the Slow Gin, which is fucking incredible.
Pretty cool stuff, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And so now that I've cracked this bottle, and this bottle was made in 2015, bottle number 5 from 2015. It shows on the back. I'm sorry. It was made in May of 2015, bottle number 3,713. I think they're only making like maybe 4,000 bottles of this a year. Wow. Maybe. It's a pretty low production. Same thing with the distiller's cuts. I think it's maybe like 1,000 bottles. Maybe. Yeah. But now that I've cracked this bottle, I'll put it back on my shelf. I'll taste it probably, I don't know, once a month over the next year. And it's just going to get a little bit bitter, which is really cool. Because when I first tried it, I was like, man, what a wild experience. It's not sugary like you'd expect, like I thought slow gins really were, you know?
It's real damn good.
Yeah. I get like tons of almond notes, lots of like rosemary. There's this like dusty sage note to it. And because it's still with all of the 47 different herbs and botanicals that are in Monkey 47 and then some extra slow berries. I mean, I still get lots of like Indian spice notes and beautiful bright citrus and it's acidic and these are like red berry notes, lots of like lingonberry, cranberry type notes.
It kind of reminds me of like, in a way, it kind of reminds me of like a bottled pink gin as well. It's got like this extra spice notes.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's really beautiful.
Yeah. What this would be? I wonder what a pink gin would taste like instead of bitters using a slow gin.
Yeah. No, we'll try it later.
So yeah, we will. With the Speakeasy Radio cocktail.
Yeah. We got a lot of work to do. But we're used to it, right? Yeah. So I just thought of something. So my first experience with Monkey 47 was about, I want to say it was like 5 or 6 years ago. When did it come into the States?
Came into the States like almost 3 years ago, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was about 5 or 6 years ago then. Mm-hmm. And was when I was working at Primeans, and a couple of my regular customers who lived in the neighborhood, they brought me a bottle.
Yeah.
When they were traveling.
That would make perfect sense. I mean, Primeats is Alpine AF.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Monkey 47 is made, you know, like pretty close to France. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they brought me a bottle of Monkey 47. I was like, I think I'd like seen something about it, like on, I don't know, social media mm-hmm. or something, but had no idea what the fuck it was. And they were like, and I was like, why? It's like, first of all, assholes, why did you bring me a half bottle if you like it so much? But I guess you just made it in half bottles back then.
Yeah.
But
where's the rest of it?
Yeah, where's the rest of it, man? But I remember tasting it and really, really liking it. And the way they told me. So, like, I have a couple of cabinets at Grand Army. We call them the boss's cabinet. Mm-hmm. That's where I put all my stuff, mm-hmm. all my special stuff. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is, like, either vintage or, like, stuff you can't get in the United States or just rare releases that are gone, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've got that bottle of Monkey 47 in my cabinet still. And I've only, like, made a couple of cocktails with it.
Mm-hmm.
I've tasted people on it mm-hmm. throughout the years, but then I still have that bottle.
Yeah.
So
you should look at the batch number on the back of your bottle.
We will.
Just tonight, I'll be there.
Also, would you sign my bottle?
Oh my God. Yes, of course I will.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's the real reason why I asked you here today.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I don't know if that's gonna help out with the value. I might take it down or not.
No, come on, whatever.
But yeah, man, that's super cool. Actually, I have a couple bottles signed by the founder as well. So
cool.
I love that stuff.
Me too.
I love that stuff. You know, someone signs the back of your bottle, it's just a story. You look at it later and you're like, oh, remember that time we were in the studio with Lacey interviewing her and I asked her to sign my bottle and she did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's cool.
So yeah, let's talk more about, sorry, that I got a little gushy there for a second. Okay. You've been rocking this brand for
since February 1st.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So
or February 2nd. I mean, I think February 1st was my last day at Clover Club. And, you know, making a transition into the more corporate side of the industry, which is what I'll call it, being on the working with a brand, and especially being full time. I don't think that's a decision that anyone should ever make lightly or it's something that takes, I think, a lot of thought and time and care because. My biggest fear in terms of working with a brand would be that I would lose my own clout, my own momentum, and my own brand by working with another brand. And if you find the right brand to work with, that doesn't happen. You both elevate yourselves.
Sure.
Your brand elevates, and the brand of whatever product you work
rising
on elevates.
Tide.
Yeah, and if it's something that you really love, it's an easy job to do. I mean, I really love this gin. I think gin is timeless and classic, and I feel like any cocktail can be made with gin. And this brand in particular, I think, is a different beast and really fun to work with and kind of crazy, and I really enjoy it. And I think that one of the hardest parts about taking this position was leaving my family at Clover Club because, like, I would probably work there until I was skin and bones. Like, you know, it's just the best place to be.
Yeah.
But when you're working with a brand, I think what's really important is you're going to be drinking it. You're going to be drinking it a lot.
Yeah.
And if it's something that you want to drink in the privacy of your own home with no one watching, then it's a good product for you.
Sure.
Right? Like if you're at home and you're like, I would love a Monkey 47 and tonic right now, or I'm going to make myself a Monkey 47 martini. And I do that at home. And that's a really great sign. That makes me feel like I really like this product and I'm really happy to be working with it. And I'm really happy to drink it. And I'm even more happy that I have a bunch of it in my house because this shit's expensive.
Yeah. that's true though. It's a difference between it's you owning the brand rather than the brand owning you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you being in a position of like understanding that you made the right decision mm-hmm. just based on like, mm-hmm. you know, like it's funny because I want to tell this to a lot of our like kind of like newer bartender listeners, you know, people that think that like brand ambassador work is just fun and games and you have an expense account and you get to party all the time. It's like, yeah, you have to be out and about and doing all the stuff and championing your brand. But it's it's a profession, and it's a professional. It was a professional move for you mm-hmm. to move into this side of the industry mm-hmm. from being behind the bar.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really wise.
You can't take it lightly, right?
No. I think that's really wise for you to sort of touch on maybe some folks who might be newer into the industry. I think that brand ambassador work tends to be glorified a little bit. People are like, they've got they just get to party all the time, and they have that credit card. Everyone loves looking at that credit card. But like, what you don't see is that there's a budget. And you don't get to just spend money willy-nilly. Like, you only spend certain money, and I only spend certain money at certain places. And every month there's always some sort of like panicked moment where I can't find a receipt or that I forgot to take a picture of it. And one of the biggest things I realized when I took this position was that I didn't fully understand that when I was not behind the bar, I wasn't working. Once I took this job, I realized, oh my God, I'm working all the time. Like, my inbox, my email, if I receive an email and it's at 12:30 at night, I feel like the other person on the other end of that email is waiting for me to respond.
Right.
Whereas with the bar, it's like, more or less, if I wasn't at the bar, then I wasn't working, right?
Sure.
And so that was something was that I would just feel like I was working all the time. But I think that it can be so... it can feel so good when a brand approaches you to see if you would like to represent their product. And it can be really tempting to say, yeah, totally, because that's a new step. It's a new level in the industry. And I think that people are really hungry for opportunities, and especially ones that involve maybe a little bit of media spotlight. But I would just recommend that you don't take a brand ambassador position until it's the brand that you want to work with.
Sure.
Like, forever. I mean, I had always said, actually, and Rachel Ford knows this, that like I would have wanted her job in a second to like be the national brand ambassador for Tanqueray and you know, work with Diageo. I was like, yeah, that's the job I want. That's not the job I got, and I'm very happy about that. But working with a gin was what I wanted, and working with the right gin. I mean, in so many ways, I'm so thankful that I didn't end up working that job. You know, I'm really happy with what I'm doing. But if I had taken some like mezcal that just came onto the market, and they were paying me a pretty penny because I had worked hard for a bit of a name, and they needed that, I would have watered down my own brand.
Sure.
My worth would have become less. My
name
like would have
become
down. No.
We like right. barrel strength.
So I think that it's just really important that you don't take every. I turned down a lot of brand ambassador positions, and it feels good to say to people like, thank you so much for thinking of me. I'm truly honored, and I would hope to have this conversation with you another time if another opportunity comes about. At this time, I'm not interested. And that's who doesn't want to hear that? I mean, like, okay, great, thanks.
Yeah. You know, I've always been a huge fan of yours, and I love going to the bar to see you at Clover Club. I'm sad that I'm not going to be able to.
I actually loved it when you'd come in because you would order a beer and sit there and just be cool. And it was really nice. We were actually chatting earlier, and you mentioned that you go in and order beers and just sit at bars. And I was like, yeah, I loved it when you'd come in. I had that thought in my head, so... Sorry,
yeah,
go ahead.
Running defense for my friends who are
working
man. Hard.
Just bringing smiles, throwing back a couple of pints, and being like, "I'm out of here."
It's like,
I'm the cocktail cowboy, and I'm out.
That's gonna be the new sign off for this show. but no, seriously, like, I just your very speedy trajectory, and like the fact that you've made so much happen, and you've inspired so many people, and been a great mentor to other bartenders it's incredible. You've done it in such a short period of time, and I'm really glad to see that you've gotten where you are and you're working with this brand, and I'm you know, it's just I'm just happy to hang out with you.
Thanks. It's been really nice, actually. We got to have a little lunch before this, and both of us were like, man, we need to hang out more.
Well,
it was nice to hang.
We are going to hang out a little bit more after this, because yeah. You're going to come and throw some drinks together with Monkey 47 at Grand Army.
Yeah, so we're just doing like a little happy hour pop-up at Grand Army. And I mean, Monkey 47 currently on the market is a fairly expensive product. I mean, I think that you can find a gin and tonic anywhere between like $16 and $24, and a more elevated cocktail from like $25 to $36. So it's not a well gin right now,
sure.
today. But we're going to put it on the happy hour menu at Grand Army. So you can come in and get, you know, Monkey 47 cocktails for like, I don't know, $12,
yep.
Which is great. And so we're going to do some gin and tonics with a little bit of lemon juice and a grapefruit twist. The only citrus that's used in Monkey 47 is lemon and grapefruit. And it's fresh citrus. It's not dried. So I think that it makes a beautiful gin and tonic. I'm making some bee's knees because I love a bee's knees. That's like probably one of my all-time favorite drinks. I love a bee's knees.
You love honey.
And I do. And then doing some Monkey 47 Gibsons.
Cool.
Have you heard of Filthy Garnish out of Miami?
Yeah.
Okay. Love those guys. And they made for us custom Monkey 47 cocktail onions based on the 47 different herbs and botanicals. And they're bright and they're crunchy and they're savory, like lots of black pepper and coriander and sage. So we're going to make some Gibsons with those and kind of release a little bit these cocktail onions that no one can buy and no one can get unless you're cool with me. So
cool.
Yeah.
I'm cool with you.
Yeah. Super cool. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. I can't wait. This is going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I guess we should pack up and head over there.
Oh my
right?
God. Is it time already?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's do it.
It is. Okay. All right.
Well, Lacey, thanks so much for being on the show. I'm excited to see you behind the bar.
Yeah. I'm excited to be there. Can we do one thing really quick before we leave?
Yeah, sure.
So, Roberta's is like, offering nutcrackers now.
Yeah.
And we have this nutcracker in front of us. And again, don't mean to put you on the spot, but I wanted to know what your nutcracker saying would be. If you're walking down the beach with like a rolling suitcase full of nutcrackers, what are you saying?
Oh my God.
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah.
Because I've thought about this. I would probably be like, nutties, get your nutties, nutcrackers, get your nutties, nutcrackers. And then there'd be some dude behind me. I'd be out there taking the money, and some dude behind me would be pulling the guy, like, you know, handing them out to people.
I'd probably just be saying, like, see it hell, motherfuckers. You want to try some of this?
Yeah.
Wait, you mean, I guess that's what I would say when I was drinking it, so...
Well, that's good.
Yeah?
Yeah. I would drink that on a beach. Nutcrackers, like, a buzz off a nutcracker is better than anything that I would bring, that anything alcoholic I could possibly bring to a beach. I'm waiting for that nutcracker guy because the buzz you get off a nutcracker is like you're floating. It's the best.
This is very good.
Yeah.
I'm glad they didn't make it too fancy.
No. No, that definitely tastes like,
could not be fancy.
100% tastes like Dole canned pineapple mm-hmm. juice. And not the little cans, but the giant one that you're like sticking a knife into to like crack it. Yeah.
Totally.
Okay. Thank you for entertaining me there.
This has been one of my favorite shows to date. All right, so let's pack up and head over to Grand Army
Sounds
and make
great.
Some drinks.
Let's do it.
Monkey 47. Thanks again, Lacey, for being on the show. we can drink that nutcracker on the train, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's it for the Speakeasy this week. Tune in to Heritage Radio Network for many more programs like this one. Until next week, I'm the Cocktail Cowboy, and I'm out.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Yeehaw!
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil wants his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.